welcome everyone to tonight's CCU webinar on working with environmental justice communities. I'm going to close the poll now. And just so you know, Jim and David, we've got a great diversity of CCU attendees. Most folks have attended a couple of times. Most folks tonight came to understand the potential conflicts between environmental justice, advocacy, and climate change. And at this point, I'll actually turn it over to you, David, to run the show.
Okay, thanks, Brett. Thanks very much. And thanks for all the help with getting this presentation put together. My name is David Holmquist. I'm the Great Lakes Regional Coordinator, one of two, and I lead a chapter in Chicago on the south side near Hyde Park and University of Chicago. I've been with CCL for about 4 years. I've been a state coordinator and a group leader liaison. I've had most of the roles in the organization. I come to the environmental justice issue from an awareness prior to my CCL work around the siting of power plants, incinerators, and various industrial activities in the Chicago area, from a broader perspective of global social justice. So that's what I bring to this. I'll get into a little bit of the work that I do, but here I do some work with environmental justice groups and try to facilitate connections between groups here in Chicago, which is part of my what I do. And so I'll let Jim introduce himself next.
Okay, I'm Jim Ryan. I was moved back to my hometown of Detroit about a year and a half ago. I work with the, in the inner city or sort of the inner city in Houston because it's Hispanic and Black communities. Since moving back to Detroit, I live just on the outskirts of Detroit and the environmental justice community is the constituency here. So this is the place to be in a changing climate, but they have problems too, but they also have lots of opportunities. And that's what I'm pursuing for myself and for Citizens Climate Lobby. But my background is I'm a geologist. I'm 70 years old and I'm white. So I don't necessarily fit into the mold of the EJ community, but I relate to their issues, or I try to relate to their issues, and I'm certainly concerned about them.
Well, we have a few learning goals for tonight's session. The first is to gain an appreciation for the scope of environmental justice history and principles. The second is to understand the potential conflicts between EJ advocacy and what we do, which is climate change mitigation advocacy. The third is to explore our work a bit through the lens of environmental justice. That term lens is one that you'll hear a lot as you start working with people in the environmental justice community. And we also hope that you'll come away with an appreciation for the importance of building long-term relationships within the EJ community. There's no short road to building alliances here, and that's what we'll want to be talking about. I, as Jim mentioned, we're both a couple of old white men, and don't think for a second that the irony is lost on us. Neither of us would say that we're deeply embedded in environmental justice work. But we are building relationships in the EJ communities in kind of EJ hotspots in the country, in Detroit and Chicago. And we're trying to develop best practices for others in CCL who want to do the same. So we're here representing the Climate and Environmental Justice Action Team. And on behalf of the other members of that team, we welcome input and participation from anyone who is or wishes to be involved with environmental justice as a CCLer. So our agenda for tonight is first of all to touch on the history of environmental justice. Second, to talk a little bit about EJ principles and the strategic or organizing model that they come from. If for anyone who saw the webinar that I did back in March, this will be some old information, but I want to make sure that people coming to this new hear it too. We're going to talk just a little bit about Carbon Washington, I-732, and the conflict that developed there between the environmental justice community and CCL and carbon tax forces in particular. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of depth, but I will recommend a couple of articles for you to read. I just want to highlight two of the issues that were really important in what happened in that referendum on the carbon tax in the state of Washington. We'll talk a little bit about, first actually, we'll talk about Jim's collaborations in Detroit. Then we'll move on to talk a little bit about the collaborations I've been involved in here in Chicago. We'll talk, I have a transcript from Marty Roach, who's another member of the EJ Action team, about her work in California recently in a coalition with environmental justice groups around an alternative to the cap and trade system out there. And I think you'll find that interesting. I want to talk just a little bit about the climate and environmental justice action team. And then we're going to do breakouts where we can have kind of an open discussion in smaller groups and hopefully have some time between Jim and myself. Debbie Chang, who's a member of the group, will join Jim. And Lisa Danz, who is also on the call, if she's able to. I know she's in transit, but if she's able to, I hope she'll join me in my breakout. So we'll start with a short video here about an event that's generally considered to have signaled the beginning of the organized EJ movement in the United States.
In a small, predominantly African-American community in eastern North Carolina called Warren County,
perfect,
African-Americans and white activists joined together in protest in what's described as a merger of civil rights and environmentalism.
The whole environmental justice movement as a movement really took off in Warren County because this was a case study where people basically drew a line in the dirt and said no more.
For nearly 4 years, the residents of Warren County have been protesting the state of North Carolina's plan to transport PCB-contaminated soil to a landfill in their community. When the trucks began to roll, angered residents decided they'd had enough. And in a nonviolent act of civil disobedience, they blocked the road.
Here you had primarily a lot of African-American women and their children who literally lay down in the streets to block the trucks from dumping polychlorinated biphenyls, PCB, in a toxic waste landfill in their community. And here's an agricultural community where the aquifer level is very shallow near the surface, where most people have wells, get their drinking water from wells. And the thought that the state would pick this county of all of the 100 counties in North Carolina as a dumping site was just unthinkable.
The Warren County incident triggered a whole series of investigations into the relationship between race and toxics. In 1983, the General Accounting Office examined the placement of off-site commercial hazardous waste landfills in 8 states in the Southeast. What they found was that 3 out of 4 were located in predominantly poor and African-American communities, in a region where African-Americans comprise only 20% of the population.
Now, that's disproportionate impact. That is not a random distribution. In other words, you're only 20% of the population, but 3 out of 4 of the landfills. And that's the first government study that actually documented this particular pattern.
In 1987, the United Church of Christ's Commission on Racial Justice issued its first report on toxic wastes and race in the U.S. The report's findings stirred up a big national debate about the relationship between where people live, the race of those communities, and the location of the toxic waste facility.
And what the 1987 report did was it verified, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that in terms of the location of toxic waste facilities, those are commercial, licensed, and those uncontrolled sites, those that are not licensed, you find an overwhelming and disproportionate amount of these facilities in African-American communities, in Latino-American communities, and other people of color communities.
The report concluded that 3 out of every 5 Hispanic and African-Americans lived in areas with uncontrolled toxic waste sites. Reverend Ben Chavis, executive director of the commission at that time, coined this phenomenon environmental racism.
Environmental racism is racial discrimination in environmental policymaking. It is the deliberate targeting of racial and ethnic communities for environmental facilities, hazard facilities like toxic waste landfills, incinerators. It is also the disproportionate presence of point generation sources of toxins like petrochemical facilities.
In 1992, the National Law Journal released the findings of its own investigation.
One of the things that became really clear to us in our data was that polluters in white communities get higher penalties for violating the law than polluters in minority communities. And that is not the case if you compare high-income and low-income areas. Their penalties are virtually the same.
The study also found that the government had taken longer to address hazards in Superfund sites located in minority communities and accepted less stringent cleanup plans.
I think once people find out what the real dangers of environmental injustice are, and there are a lot of dangers, people will really get involved. Because we often say that the issue of environmental racism is an issue of life and death. It's just not an issue of some form of prejudice. Where somebody doesn't like you because of the color of your skin. This is an issue that will take your life away if you don't get involved.
Good. This is a still from the video we just watched. The venue will look familiar to anyone who's visited the homepage of CCL, the website, or has been to a national conference. The rally that's pictured here on the Capitol steps was part of the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit in October of 1991. This was a gathering of about 300 people, it was international as well, mostly from the United States and Latin America. But in that summit meeting, the EJ movement began what has become a very distinct history and tradition and strategic framework because of these early organizing efforts starting in Warren County, and because of the research that was done subsequent to that. You may be thinking that that the reason that low-income, low to moderate income, and communities of color end up in toxic environments is because they move there because it's inexpensive. That is not the case. There's been a lot of study done, particularly by Dr. Robert Bullard, who was pictured in that video, featured in the video. He's considered the father of environmental justice and has done a considerable amount of research, he and other people, that demonstrates clearly that the siting of these toxic facilities, incinerators, coal-burning power plants is done intentionally, and that they're placed in what people in the movement like to refer to as sacrifice zones. I would submit to you that one of our goals should be to a world where there are no sacrifice zones. The strategic framework I'm talking about grew out of the civil rights and human rights movements, and it's really all about universal values paired with local struggles. One output of the leadership summit was a set of 17 principles of environmental justice, which still guides the EJ movement. As with any movement, these principles and values are held more strongly by some people than by others. They speak to just relationships between people, the earth, and the economy. And I'm not going to go through the principles themselves. We do this sometimes on our calls. But I do want to talk a little bit about kind of characterize them a little bit. With regard to the earth, they call out the principles call attention to sacredness, to ecological independence, to sustainability, they used the word back then, and ethical use of land and resources, and protection for nature from the risks of extraction, nuclear testing, and hazardous wastes. With regard to peoples, they demand respect, self-determination in the political, cultural, and environmental realm, equal protection or participation, excuse me, in the formation of public policy at all levels of decision making and at all times in that process, protection from the risks of extraction, nuclear and testing and hazardous wastes, here again for people as opposed to nature, or not along with nature, not as opposed to, and the right of all people to a safe and clean environment in the community and the workplace. This is an important principle, and it's often phrased as a premise that people shouldn't have to choose between a job and a livelihood and a safe environment, as I say, either in the workplace or at home in their communities. With respect to the economy, the principles call for regenerative urban and rural ecological policies and practice to rebuild communities. And this is a policy focus of the EJ movement that distinguishes them from the work that we do. The cessation of the production of all toxins, hazardous wastes, and radioactive materials. The radioactive materials come up here partly because of an aversion to nuclear, but it also has to do with the fact that a very large portion of the uranium mined in the United States is mined on indigenous lands, on Native American reservation lands. They oppose the destructive practices of multinational corporations and military occupation and economic exploitation. And they call for a commitment to living lightly on the earth, minimizing waste, and ensuring the health of the earth for future generations. So it kind of begs the question of what justice entails. And for the environmental justice movement, it entails the rights of victims of environmental injustice to full compensation and reparations, the recognition of the special legal relationship of Native peoples to their governments, the principle that government acts of environmental injustice are violations of international law, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and the United Nations Convention on Genocide. And that's a repeat, sorry. Some of the categories, exploitation, reparations, are kind of buzzwords that maybe some of us aren't comfortable with. That along with discussions around race, white privilege, white supremacy, and what white people should do about it, which is an issue that's been raised to very high relief in the last 10 days or so. All of this you will hear a lot about in the environmental justice movement. In 1996, a group of the Southwest, let's see, let me get my notes. A group of Southwest environmental activists met in Yemez, New Mexico, and propounded the Yemez principles of democratic organizing. These two are important principles in the environmental justice movement. If any of you were in the environmental justice, climate justice breakout at the national conference, you heard Corrine Taylor of an organization called REACT talk about these. There are six of them, and I'm not going to go into detail on them. These, along with the 17 principles, are posted on the Buddy Drive for the action team. But the principles include number one, be inclusive. Number two, an emphasis on bottom-up organizing. Number three, letting people speak for themselves. Very important. Working together in solidarity and mutuality. Building just relationships amongst ourselves. And a commitment to self-transformation. Now, that to me is an interesting principle. It should resonate with most of us in CCL. Transformation is one of our core principles as well. There is the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice, who met in 1996. And that meeting was about globalization and trade. I mentioned Karine Taylor. This is a still from the video of the presentation for climate justice at the National Conference in June. I highly recommend this if you haven't seen it or haven't had a chance to look at the video. It's a very good presentation. She was one of three presenters, and it's well worth watching. We may also hear from Ms. Taylor sometime soon on a monthly call. We're kind of hoping. She is the federal policy advocate for We Act for Climate Justice, which is an organization in New York. Brett, do you want to try to play this next one? This is a short video about, and I entitled it, What Environmental Justice Does. It's actually a video that was produced by We Act. And it pictures the type of work and type of volunteer organization that happens in local struggles in the environmental justice movement around the country. So, Brett,
here we go.
In these areas, many environmental issues impact and affect all of our daily lives.
Why is it that, you know, so many children have to go away in an ambulance?
I'd start getting ready to cry, thinking of what's going to happen. And it scares me.
Communities of color tend to be disproportionately affected.
People of low income and people of color, you know, don't have clean air, clean water, access to fresh goods.
We need to live in a space that will not kill us.
Environmental justice means to me the person has an understanding of their environment and the ability to have a say of how that environment influences them and their family.
There shouldn't be any lead in water. Our children are slower. You're poisoning them.
Waste treatment facilities, bus stations, there's just a lot here that you wouldn't see, you know, in the West Village.
I raised my two kids in this. Three of my grandchildren were born living in this. The justice is correcting the issues.
Why is this happening to my daughter? Why is this happening to my colleagues? Why is this happening to my cousin? You know, I want to do something about it.
Never in my wildest dreams would I believe anything would have gotten done. With We Act behind me, I was able to get out there, voice what I needed to voice, get things done.
We Act as a place to defend justice.
Without them, I would have given up. I'm just happy to be a member of We Act. Yeah.
Okay, this is Jim in Detroit again. I thought that was a good segue. When I came back to Detroit about a year and a half ago, you know, I wanted to go and to try and promote, you know, what I thought was a citizens' climate lobby answer to dealing with climate change. Well, I knew enough to just reach out and go to meetings, and that's what I did. And just to, because I was coming in new and I didn't want to make any stupid mistakes. I'll just go ahead and jump right to what I consider my success so far is that nobody's screamed at me or told me not to come back. So I can't say that people have signed on to the Citizens Climate Lobby plan, but I keep going back and to just to be there and to join in their efforts. Now, on the screen is some of the organizations that, like I said, I came back to Detroit, and I just attended as many sessions that were related to the environment, environmental justice, or climate, anything that had in the title of the announcement. So I would show up, and if I introduced myself, I would give my CCL card, but other than that, you know, if somebody asked, well, what is CCL, I would tell them, but I, you know, did not get on the soapbox and start, you know, preaching the gospel. In fact, well, what I, like I said, I went to as many meetings as I could. I'm retired. I can afford to do that. And then when an opportunity came up, well, let me drop back. I would try and do things jointly. So I was trying to think of things to do. Like one of the organizations I was working with is the Detroit Climate Action Collaborative. What they do is they go out and they look at adaptation ways, like putting in rain gardens and things like that. You know, urban farms, things that will sort of help people adapt to climate change. So I would attend that, but I'm not really a farmer, and I don't live in the inner city, so I didn't have the opportunity to make these rain gardens. But I came up with an idea of having an editorial board meeting with our local newspaper, the Detroit Free Press, and I invited the leadership of the Detroit Climate Action Collaborative to join in on this this editorial board. So I promoted that to the paper, and in fact, the first time that the DCAC heard my spiel on Citizens Climate Lobby was at that editorial board meeting. So subsequently, I've gone and met with people and done this, just trying to interact with folks again, just waiting for them to ask me, you know, what is Citizens Climate Lobby before I go in and, you know, give the spiel. Because one thing I'm still learning, you know, what they need. And well, when I go to these sessions and like the WEAG video showed, there are a lot of problems in these areas. Detroit, I went to one high school, River Rouge. 20% of the student body has asthma. You know, it's very bad pollution problems here. I went to a town hall where the engineer that the 1,200 homes flooded during a rainstorm last August. And the engineers came in and said this was climate change, and it was climate change, but a lot of these folks, this is the second time their basements had flooded in 2 years. They weren't really wanting to talk about climate change. They wanted to know how to, alleviate the problems they were have with their basements. And, you know, these are flooded not with rainwater, but with sewage water because we have combined systems here. So again, what I've done is I've just gone and gone to as many meetings as I could. Current project now is a lot of these organizations here, we're trying to organize a panel discussion for mayoral and the city council at large. We have a mayoral election in November, and we're trying to get the mayoral candidates, the present mayor, Mike Duggins, to join in this panel discussion. The theme of the panel is moving Detroit forward, environmental justice in a changing climate. So again, talking about climate, but as just sort of a part of environmental justice. And we've joined in with, again, the DCAC, which is part of Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice. We had the NAACP Detroit join in with us, and they now have a climate change group, the local Sierra Club, and also the People's Water Board, a very big issue with water shutoffs here. And then also we joined with at least now two student organizations at Wayne State University. So this is what we're doing. Again, not preaching the Citizens Climate Lobby, but just being there, working with these folks. And then when the opportunity arises, oh, this is what we do, and we have to worry about climate change. They have so many other worries. Climate change is going to make it worse. But, you know, I try not to push that other than when the opportunity comes up. So that's about what I have to say. So, David, you can go ahead and take it about Chicago.
Thank you, Jim. I'd like to just make a quick comment about what Jim said about how people in frontline communities, low and moderate income communities of color, have lots of problems to deal with. They're existential problems, as Dr. Chavez said in the video. These are life and death issues. They have other life and death issues. Here in Chicago, police violence is that sort of an issue. They're beginning to feel as if white nationalism is an existential issue. You hear talk about fears of extermination now in communities of color. And all of this ethos bleeds into the environmental movement in environmental justice communities. So on the one hand, we need to be aware that climate change isn't going to be at the top of the list of most people of color, particularly in low and moderate income communities. However, we don't want to use that as an excuse not to reach out to them. And I think that's an important point. Here in Chicago, this is what I want to show you a few photos here of what it looks like at the south end of Lake Michigan. This is what's called the KCBX Petcoke terminal. Petcoke is basically the bottom of the refining process of tar sands oil. And just across the state line, this is in southeast Chicago, right near the Indiana state line. On the other side of the state line is the BP tar sands refinery, which, don't get too far ahead of me here, is the largest tar sands refinery in the country. Tar sands oil comes down to that refinery through a pipeline system that runs along both shores of Lake Michigan. Chicago is a transit hub for crude oil in pipelines, barges, and rail cars. This is oil transport central for the United States, as it always has been because of its location. It's been a transportation hub for all sorts of industrial development. This petcoke is a material that can be burned. It can be used as a byproduct, sometimes in asphalt. It is toxic. It's a fine powder, and what the previous slide showed is how they move it, or were moving it, from pile to pile through conveyors that made it airborne. This ended up, in the previous slide, you see this facility located adjacent to this residential neighborhood. And you're looking west there toward the prevailing winds. So the prevailing winds carry that petcoke dust right into that residential neighborhood. A group in that area called the Southeast Side Coalition to Ban Petcoke has worked for 4 years. They have finally managed to have the piles removed. The next photograph shows, and you can see them here, go to the next one. Sorry, Brett. These vertical lines are water pipes, and you can see at the top, some of them are spraying water. That's how they mitigated the dust, was by spraying down these piles. That didn't work. The city refused to force KCBX, which is owned by the Koch brothers, to cover the piles. Finally, they forced them to remove the piles, but they still transit the material through there from rail to barge. And when it's transported by rail and barge, those conveyances are not covered. The next slide, this is the refinery. It looks kind of small. It's actually huge. It covers about 2 square miles. You see an oil train, crude oil train, alongside it. And the residents of the southeast side have joined together with the residents of Whiting, Indiana, across the line, formed a coalition of a 350.org chapter in Whiting, Northwest Indiana, and what's called the Calumet area in southeast Chicago, to protest the refinery and the toxic effects of it in terms of the byproducts. There is also steel industry in Whiting. And oddly enough, when they discovered or when they got rid of, in the course of getting rid of the pet coke piles, they put in air quality monitors, which found airborne manganese coming from a facility, a transit facility. Manganese has been going through that neighborhood, it turns out, for 100 years. It's used in the manufacture of steel. And this, there's one large steel mill still left in this area. There used to be many. And the toxic legacy of the steel industry there is still with us. So these are the kinds of challenges that that people in these communities have, and it's not just about where they live, whether it comes to the matter of what surrounds them or their exposure to the impacts of climate change. That's important, but what's even more important is their lack of resilience because of their lack of income. And when you hear people talk about white privilege, I want to interject this. I think most of us have the privilege of not having to know what this looks like, what it's like to live in a community like this, and to have your choices limited by virtue of being low or moderate income, particularly in an area like Chicago. There are not good affordable housing choices. So all of this causes a focus in the environmental justice community on justice number one, on social justice combined with environmental justice and the impacts of climate change, and a focus on adaptation as an opportunity to redevelop communities. And what environmental justice communities strive for is, particularly at the state level, and they've just accomplished this in Illinois, to have funds allocated. They're not yet appropriated because Illinois still has a budget crisis. And we have a budget finally here, but we still have a budget crisis. We didn't have a budget for 4 years. And the focus on national policy is also about making sure that money gets spent in their communities for redevelopment. After having their communities used as sacrifice zones here in Chicago for over 100 years now, they refuse now to be told to go wait in line. They bristle when they hear Bob Inglis, for instance, say that environmental justice is going to have to wait because climate change is such an urgent problem. That does not resonate well with them. So these are some of the conflicts that come up. And briefly to talk about what happened in Carbon, Washington, which highlights some of this, the environment, and there were NGO politics involved in this too, but at the level of principle, the two major issues had to do with revenue neutrality versus revenue positive policy, which is what I was just talking about. Environmental justice communities will be attracted generally to the idea of taxing the fossil fuel industries. That seems almost punitive. They will be attracted to the notion of a dividend. They might want to see it targeted more toward low and middle income communities, but they favor the dividend. The problem is that they don't trust markets and they want to see revenue spent in their communities. So that's principle number one. The second principle that was at work there was a skepticism and really a reluctance to deal in a bipartisan manner. Most people in environmental justice communities do not believe that Republicans can be brought to the table on the climate issue. There are a lot of Democratic lawmakers, particularly here in Chicago, who feel the same way. Most of them are supportive of our policy. They just don't think that we have a chance of passing it. The growth of the Climate Solutions Caucus is the best argument we have here. And I've had some luck just by describing what goes on there as what's happened with the Climate Solutions Caucus. As Carla Wise said, I don't know if for anyone who saw the progressive messaging webinar from last week, this is a really persuasive argument with Democrats and progressives who have assumed that we won't be able to bring Republicans to the table. I want to second what Jim said, and the way that I've gone about my work is not to go in to represent CCL. I work with the Southeast Side Coalition to ban petcoke. I was part of the demonstration you're seeing here that was sponsored by 350.org and the environmental justice community in Chicago in May of 2016 at Whiting. Not necessarily as CCL outreach, but as allyship in causes that I think are important and that I really care about. And I think that that kind of authenticity is what you need to be able to bring to this work. There's no formula. There's no scale of values that we can really apply across the board to environmental justice groups. Going back to a very popular way of describing conservative versus liberals in terms of values, which Carla talked about last week as Jonathan Haidt's six touchstones of values. Nowhere in his six values do you hear the word justice. Justice is paramount in these communities. I want to talk a little bit about the San Francisco Bay Area. As I said, Marty Roach has been involved in work on SB 775 there. I got to get to her notes. She can't be with us tonight. So I'm going to read to you the description of that effort that she wrote. In April this year, CCLers in California organized to support a local effort for an equitable and effective carbon pricing system in California after 2020. This was necessitated by the political judgment that California had to renew its cap and trades program or face possible legal action challenging the program. So the law that they proposed required all taxation policies, which was what they proposed with SB 775, to a two-thirds vote of the California legislature, which is required for tax measures. What they proposed was an innovative cap and trade program with a carbon tax feature, SB 775, and CCL worked on that. It was organized under the name CalFact, or Californians for a Carbon Tax, and they have a website called CalFact.org. They took this step for that type of policy because the leading environmental justice groups in California also favored that approach. So they purposely tried to avoid the issues that arose in Washington. And they started from the beginning devising the policy with input from the environmental justice community, which was not, according to the environmental justice community, a priority for Yoram Bauman when he formulated the Washington carbon tax proposal. The EJ groups engaged in education and lobbying for the bill through CALFACT. As it turned out, Governor Brown didn't support it. He pushed through a reauthorization of cap and trade with a lot of features that were supported by the Western States Petroleum Association. And although it's been hailed as a reauthorization of an effective program, most people, I think, in CCL and in the environmental justice community in California wouldn't agree with that assessment. A quick word about, I think one of the places we need to go as a group, Brett, if you can advance, part of the environmental, a major feature of the environmental justice movement is talk about a just transition. There's an organization called the Climate Justice Alliance, which is a coalition of environmental justice groups. Also the Climate Justice Leadership Coalition, which was formed by WEACT. They are mounting just transition principles, trying to provide employment, particularly through unions, where they have any strength at all, for people who will be displaced in the drawdown of the fossil fuel industry. This is something that CCL's oil team is also interested in. And Jim, in addition to being involved in the in environmental justice, involved with the oil team. And this is organized around the just transition provisions, the aspirational provisions that were included in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And I think that coming together with environmental justice movements around this issue will be helpful for CCL. A quick takeaway for this webinar, we as an action team, first of all, we want to make the point that environmental justice is about diversity regarding race and class, but it involves more than diversity. It demands inclusivity, and this notion of prior consultation with communities that will be impacted by policy. We'd like to serve as a hub for CCL volunteers to learn from one another as we do this work. And we're not concentrating so much on messaging, but on mindset, trying to understand what's unique and existentially important to the environmental justice community. So there's contact information for us, for Jim and myself. You can navigate to our action team on community, and we welcome all the help that we can get as we try to spread this word, to develop cooperative work across the country. We just established a relationship with two staffers for Friends of the Earth, one of whom was working on California, one of whom is part of a presentation that's about to happen here in Chicago. So these good things can happen when we all get together and share ideas. Brett, you want to call us into rooms?
Well, on behalf of all of us here on the webinar tonight, we really want to make sure to thank both David and Jim for their time, for this invaluable perspective and lens into such a critical community and group of communities throughout the country to reach out to. We hope you found tonight's webinar useful and valuable. Again, any feedback, please send to us. We always are striving to make each of our webinars even more accessible and oriented towards what you want to learn. And wishing everyone a wonderful night. Thank you.